Fred Film Radio, Venice Film Festival, Italy.
So, my name is Annalisa Sandrelli. I'm a university lecturer. I teach in that university, UNINT Università, Università degli Studi Internazionali. It's in Rome. It's a very small university with a department in translation and interpreting, which is where I teach. I am a trained and practicing conference interpreter and subtitler. And since my student days, I've always taken interest in film subtitling, which was a bit unusual at the time in Italy, because as you will hear in the talk, and you probably know already, Italy, by tradition, is a dubbing country, so there wasn't a lot of subtitling being done at the time. But I've always enjoyed doing things in different ways and, you know, not following the mainstream, so I guess that's why I chose that topic for my dissertation. So anyway, in our department, we train translators and interpreters, and some of them obviously want to work in cinema, and that's why we also have an MA, a specialised course in translating for the cinema. And I hope Ilaria won't mind me saying that she's one of the former students. So, so anyway, there's a little gem, little secret there. As for myself, I've been translating films for 25 years, or longer than I care to remember. Mostly from English, but also from Spanish, which is my other working language. And I also do the proofreading and the revising from other languages that, you know, I know and understand, but don't consider as a proper working language, like French, for example. So I can't speak French. My French accent is terrible, but I can understand it. Translating cinema. You will see an outline of the talk in a minute. It's about what do we mean when we translate a film, what it is that you need to translate, and some techniques and some tips, some things to look out for when you're translating a film. But before I delve into the topic, I'd like to hear a bit more about you and why you chose this workshop, where your interest lies, whether you are students of film or aspiring filmmakers or aspiring audiovisual translators, perhaps. So perhaps we can go around the room quickly. You can tell me who you are, where you're from.
So my name is Pauline. I'm from Luxembourg. And my connection to cinema is actually that I'm an actress.
Okay.
And I also like to be behind the camera.
Uh-huh.
And I think that the workshop seeing and translating cinema can be very useful for me because I, as I said, I'm sometimes behind the camera as an assistant of the director.
Mm-hmm.
And there I can give more of my ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And how something can be transmitted.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
Yeah, my name is Daniel, I'm from Denmark. And my interest in cinema is mostly watching it and analyzing the symbolical perspective mostly. My interest in this workshop stems from, I'm really interested in the choice of words when you translate,
yeah,
like translating the proper meaning,
mm-hmm,
because the language is very powerful, and therefore the choice of words,
mm-hmm,
is just as meaningful. Yeah,
yes, important. I agree. We'll talk about film dialogue. Yes.
My name is Ioan. I'm from Romania. I have no direct link to cinema, I've seen it as a passion till now,
mm-hmm,
but I would like to work maybe in industry, maybe in editing or something like that.
Okay, well, editing does play a role in this,
yeah. You
will hear.
Hi, my name is Monty, I'm from Sweden, and well, I'm really interested in this particular workshop because I love languages and I really want to learn what you lose and what you gain when, mm-hmm, you see something that's not in your native tongue.
Hi, I'm Elsa, I'm from Finland. My connection to film is I really want to be a director, but I also, the reason I picked this workshop is because this is like the field of filmmaking I know the least about, so I'd love to know more about the translating process and,
mm-hmm,
Yeah, good.
Hi, my name is Pekka, I'm from Estonia. I study animation at the university, and I just always felt intrigued by different languages.
It's good enough. Good enough reason.
Hello, I'm Job from the Netherlands. I did my BA in documentary filmmaking, and now I'm doing my MA in sociology. And I'm really interested in this workshop also because in the Netherlands there's no dubbing at all, like you only read the subtitles all the time. Mm-hmm. So I really can see why it is super important to have a good sub.
Hi, I'm Tomás and I'm from Portugal. I'm now studying film, so I want to do something with filmmaking. And like I'm in this workshop because I think it is so sad that like we as filmmakers don't really think about the accessibility of cinema. Mm-hmm. And for example, I would really want to film to have more to be more accessible to everyone. Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested in knowing how can I make a film and that it can be approachable to more people than just the ones that can see and listen, etc.
Hi, I'm Adam from Hungary, Budapest, and I'm really interested in things around the camera and some editing work as well. And I found this topic really interesting for me because having a particular language of film sometimes made a conflict. I mean, I felt sometimes that it can be an obstacle. For example, if I watch a film with my parents and they don't speak really good English, and I can't stand watching a film not in an original language, so I'm interested in the topic, how we should resolve it.
Yeah, I understand.
Hello, my name is Maya. I'm from Croatia. I'm a student editor. Finishing my master's, and I was interested in this workshop because I've throughout the years I've been learning foreign languages like French and Spanish a little bit, and I was always interested in the differences, especially in the dialogue moment. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. I believe it will be really interesting.
Okay. Well, thank you. That's given me a bit of an overview of your existing skills and competences about the topic. And the way I have structured this is as follows. So first, we are going to talk about film as a macro sign, and I will explain what it means in a minute. It's not difficult. I know it sounds a bit daunting, but it's not. And accessible filmmaking. Some of you have already mentioned the topic of accessibility, which is the topic of another workshop, but I'm going to touch upon it at the very beginning because it's related to translation as well. Then I'm going to give you a brief historical background of the various audiovisual translation modes, why dubbing was imposed in some countries and subtitling in others, and so on. Then we're going to focus on subtitling primarily because it's the leading mode in festivals, and also on streaming platforms at the minute. So it's on the rise. It's constantly evolving, subtitling, and its constraints, the technical constraints, what you have to take into account when you're subtitling a film. And then, if we have time towards the very end, I'm going to tell you a little bit about the technological turn, how technological advances are changing subtitling workflows at the minute, because in the past it used to be done by one or two people, almost manually, with the help of dedicated software, but almost manually. But now you have software like speech recognition, machine translation, that can help, perhaps, if it is used in the proper way, can help ease the burden on the subtitler's shoulders. But you have to know how to use it, and you have to know what to, you know, the benefits of existing technology, but also its limits, because at the minute, a fully automated subtitling workflow is not possible for various reasons. So, first of all, what do we mean when we talk about an audiovisual text? And by text, we mean film or TV series or anything on the web, any video content. It's a semiotic construct woven by a series of signifying codes that operate simultaneously to produce meaning. We'll see what it means in a minute. I have a little diagram. For the translator, this means that you have to try and understand the meaning and the functioning of each of these codes and the possible impact of all signs, linguistic and non-linguistic, on translation operations. This is a quote by Frederick Chalmers, who is a Spanish translation scholar specialized in dubbing. And I've chosen it because it exemplifies exactly what I'm going to tell you now, which is this. So in the center, you see the concept of film. Film
film is obviously, in modern terms, when we think of film, we think of something that includes both verbal signs and non-verbal signs. It includes a sound channel with soundtrack, with music, noise, dialogues, etc., and also visual channel, images. And it's worth mentioning at this point that it wasn't always like this. In the silent era, when film was invented, it was purely visual. The only music or sound effects took place during projection. There would be somebody playing the piano or somebody making a gun noise at the appropriate point during the projection, but it would be somebody voicing it, you know, there and then. It wasn't recorded because the technology didn't allow it. But to our modern minds, when we think of film, we always think of images and sound, dialogue and images. And the codes that Frederick Chalmers alluded to are what? Editing. Film editing is a very specific aspect of film language. You don't find it in the theatre, for example. When you go to a theatre and you watch a play, you are free to look at anything you want on the stage. Whereas in film, because of the editing, you're basically looking at what the director and the editor want you to look at in that particular scene. Unless you fall asleep, of course, but you know, if you're watching a film, you're basically following somebody else's gaze. Then you have different shot types, and viewers know what they mean. So if you see somebody in a close-up or with a tear, you know that that character is feeling low. Or if you see somebody in a long shot with stooped shoulders, you think, oh, they're tired or they're worried about something. So the narrative is related to the type of film shots that director and editor choose together. Then, of course, there are different conventions depending on different film genres. A Western is not the same as a rom-com, right? And we all know that there are conventions that directors adhere to or decide to violate for their own reasons. And you also have hybrid films that mix different genres together, especially now. Different narrative styles, because not all directors are the same. A film by Paolo Sorrentino is not the same as a film by Paul Schrader. They're completely different. You have the costumes, the hair, the makeup, and all of these things together, all these codes that Chalmers mentioned, are the ones that produce the meaning. So when you're translating a film, what do you translate, do you think? Out of all of this information, what needs to be translated?
The verbal signs.
The verbal signs. And what are the verbal signs? First of all?
Words.
Yes. Dialogue, yes. But words is more appropriate, actually. Because in a film, there's not just dialogue. There can also be songs. And there can be visual verbal signs. So the most obvious answer is acoustic verbal signs, film dialogues and songs if they're relevant to the plot, but also visual verbal signs. So you can have maybe a scene in which an email is displayed or a text message or a newspaper headline or a shop name. It might be relevant for the plot. You might want to translate laundrette, what is it, so that viewers understand where the character is going. What you don't translate are the acoustic non-verbal signs, the noises, the music, the sound effect, and also, of course, the images, the acting. But just because you don't translate the stuff on the right-hand side of the screen, it doesn't mean that it's not relevant. It is entirely relevant because it conditions your translation choices. You can't change those things. You have the images, you have the acting, you have the expressions and the body language of the actors, and that's, you know, your datum. You can't change it. So your translation needs to be adapted to that specific visual part. Okay? So when we talk about accessibility, in a wider sense, you are referring to all the translation modes and all the techniques that you can use to make a film accessible to anyone beyond both language and sensorial barriers. So whether the obstacle is of a linguistic nature, so you're trying to watch a film in Portuguese and you can't speak Portuguese, so you need a translation, or whether you are blind, you can't see the images, you can only listen to the soundtrack, or you are deaf, you can look at the film but you can't understand what people are saying because it's a foreign film and so you can't lip read, you can only lip read in your own language. the process is the same. You try to make the film accessible to everyone because everyone has the same rights to enjoy information, culture, and entertainment as well, right? Another important aspect, which is getting more and more relevant nowadays, is that whereas in the past most films tended to be monolingual, and the fact that, you know, the presence of two or three languages in the same film was an exception rather than the rule, now it's the other way around. You have entire TV series or entire films featuring two or three or more languages. I don't know if you've seen the series The Americans. It's a spy thriller on Netflix, and it's about two Russians undercover in the US in the 80s. It's the entire series is in both English and Russian, because when they're speaking between each other, they speak Russian, and when they're interacting with other people, it's in American English. And they're becoming more and more popular. So that means that it's becoming even more relevant to make content accessible to everyone. And it's also more important in terms of in terms of business, because if you can make the film or the TV series accessible to more people, it means potentially more revenue. Okay? If we talk about accessibility as in widening inclusion, we can talk about film translation in a wider sense, both in the same language, accessibility for the sensory disabled, or across languages. So what do we translate? How do we translate it? Well, there's a range of different language translation modes. In red, subtitling, which is the main topic today, but also revoicing, which is a blanket term for dubbing, voiceover, simulsync, which is a kind of asynchronous dubbing used for various TV modes, TV programs, and the range of sensory accessibility modes, the subtitles for the deaf and hard of hearing, audio description for the blind and visually impaired, audio introductions, audio subtitles, which sounds a bit weird, but it's simply if you are blind and you want to watch a Pedro Almodovar film, and you live in a country where the main translation mode is subtitling, like England, for example, the Almodovar film in cinemas is shown with English subtitles. But if you're blind, you have no use for them. And if you can't speak Spanish, you can't go to the cinema because you won't understand a thing. So you also have audio subtitles, which you can download to your phone on an app. You put your headphones in, you go to the cinema with your friends, who can see, and they watch the film the normal way, and you watch the film listening to a voice reading the subtitles for you. So there are different ways of making the film accessible to everyone, and it's extremely important because I don't know if you know any blind or deaf people, but a lot of them, especially in the past, used to lead very secluded lives. Because it wasn't possible to join in with the family, with friends, by going to the cinema together or the theatre together. Nowadays, it's becoming a bit more widespread, the idea of making it accessible to them. If you go to the theatre at certain times, on certain days, they show surtitles, so subtitles above the main stage, and people who are deaf can follow. In some countries, it's more widespread than others. Francesca will tell you about it next week. In Italy, we're still struggling, but the concept has been introduced in the past few years, and so now we do have some performances, for example, in opera, that are made accessible to the blind and to the deaf in various ways. The blind, for example, are invited to the dress rehearsal. And after the dress rehearsal, they are introduced to the actors and the singers, and they can touch the fabrics. They can, they can talk to the person who makes the costumes, who describes the costumes and why they're made in a certain way. They are allowed to explore the stage and touch everything, the furniture and everything, so that when they go and watch the performance, they have a mental image, and they can place the performance in the space that they have explored personally. So it's not impossible. Of course, they enjoy the performance in a different way, not like we do, but it's important to enable them to do it. So going back to film, I'll introduce another concept, which is gaining ground, luckily, accessible filmmaking. Accessible filmmaking means that instead of considering translation and accessibility services as a post-production operation, something that you think of after you've completed the film, your film has been bought by France, or your film is competing in a festival, and, ooh, I have to provide the subtitles because I have to send it abroad. It's a post-production operation nowadays. People think about it only when it's too late, in a sense. Rather than doing that, you think of making your film accessible in terms of language and in terms of accessibility modes during the filmmaking process. And it's important because if you consider the viewing experience of foreign and sensory impaired audiences, filmmakers can gain full control of their work. Somebody said before, I think you mentioned the importance of words, of dialogues in films. Of course, if you spend maybe a year writing a script, and then that script goes into production, and maybe it takes another 6 months to make it into a film, or maybe even longer, you as a creator of the film, director, scriptwriter, you have every interest in how your foreign audiences will perceive your film because you've thought so much about what the character says in that scene. So why would you leave the translation of those very important words to somebody you don't know, somebody who is paid a pittance, somebody who's not chosen by you? Because this is what happens now. At the minute, when you sell your film abroad, it's the distribution company that deals with finding a translator. And it could be anybody. Sometimes they're very good, sometimes they're not. They have no contact with the filmmakers. They can't ask, oh, but when the character says this, what did you actually mean? What is the weight of this word in that scene? As translators, we very seldom have a chance of discussing these issues with filmmakers. Incidentally, festivals are one of the rare occasions when we do have a chance of meeting filmmakers, because when you're preparing the electronic subtitles for Venice, for example, Paolo Sorrentino wants to make sure that the translation is correct, and because his English is rather good, he will sit there with you and look at every word and comment and ask for changes. But it's not that common in the bigger market. You know, film festivals are a niche. They're not the entire audiovisual market. Think of Netflix. Netflix films and TV series are being translated all the time. Some translators are very experienced. Some are recent graduates who have no experience at all and no contact with the makers whatsoever. So the quality varies. You know, sometimes it's excellent and sometimes it's not at all. And, interestingly, over 50% of the revenue obtained by most films nowadays comes from translated and accessible versions. But only between 0.1% and 1% of the budget is spent on these additional versions. Now, don't you think it's a bit absurd? You know, that you spend so much time and effort making your film and then you lose control over it completely. That's not great. So we're trying to push this this concept. Pablo Romero Fresco is a lecturer, audiovisual translator, and filmmaker who's been trying to push this concept more and more. And the idea is that in the same way that you have somebody who is in charge of the hair and makeup department, you should appoint somebody who's in charge of the language and accessibility versions to be involved in the filmmaking process from the very beginning, from the early stages, for a very simple reason, because if that person can sit in at least some of the meetings between the director and screenwriter who work on the script, that person will become aware of the various nuances in the dialogue and will therefore be equipped much better when it comes to translating it or when it comes to creating an audio description script for the blind. Okay, and it wouldn't cost much because we're quite cheap. So, as you saw, or as I mentioned before, some audiovisual translation modes are intralingual in the same language, subtitles for the deaf in Italian, in Italy, in English, in the UK, in French, in France, etc. Others are interlingual from one language to another. Some are done live. AD, audio description for the opera, for example, can be done live, or should be done live, because an opera performance changes every night. It's not exactly the same every single night, so you can't record it, because the description needs to fit in the pauses of the music. You can't overlap with the singer. That would be a disaster. So you do it live. But for films, you can pre-record it, luckily. And some of them involve a diamesic shift and others don't. What does it mean? That you change from the spoken channel to the written channel, or from spoken to spoken, written to spoken, or visual to verbal. An audio description for the blind tries to describe what is shown on the screen for the person who can't see the images. So, of course, this shift is possibly the hardest aspect of all audiovisual translation modes. For example, because there are some things that you can say that are typical of conversation, but you can't really write when it comes to colloquial language. So when you see, I don't know, a taboo word in writing, it has a much bigger effect than hearing it. So, you know, you have to be careful there, because you don't want to betray the original spirit, but at the same time, you don't want the impact to be heightened. And this is more or less the same thing, just for your convenience, they've been arranged by category, revoicing methods. They're called revoicing because you're basically replacing the voices in the original. Dubbing. Post-synchronization is simply when you do it in the same language, when you basically reshoot a scene because the sound is not great. For example, when they have shot a scene with live sound outside and there's street noises and you can't hear anything, and you do it again in the dubbing booth, but there's no translation there. Then a voiceover is like dubbing, but it's not synchronous, so you don't necessarily have to reflect the same lip movement of the actors that you see on the screen. It's much easier, and it's used for journalistic reports or for reality TV shows, because it's not worth it. I mean, it's not worth spending so much money and time trying to reflect the same lip movements of Gordon Ramsay in one of his cookery programs. And basically, it's all swear words anyway. So, simultaneous interpreting is sometimes used in film festivals if there's no time for the subtitles. Audio description and audio introduction are revoicing methods. And then titling, subtitling, SDH, digital subtitling, surtitling, used mostly in the theatre. Live subtitling, which we're not going to have time to talk about today, but it's what you use on television for news programmes or interviews. So when it's not something recorded, you still need to subtitle it for the deaf. Or across languages, if there's a statement by Joe Biden on the troops, American troops leaving Afghanistan, and it's live, people want to know what he's talking about, and you have to subtitle him live, and audio subtitles. So, how did we get here? Briefly, a bit of history, hopefully not too boring. As you know, when cinema was invented, it was silent, it was just images, and it was considered a universal language. Because, you know, a film, a silent film with Charlot, you know, Charlie Chaplin, it was comprehensible everywhere. There was no need to translate anything, except sometimes some intertitles, you know, those subtitles that appeared between one image and the other. They were not superimposed on the same images. But they said only things like New York 1912 or He's Not Happy. So it was really easy to translate those and then distribute the films abroad. And then, of course, when sound was invented, Does anybody know more or less when?
1931.
Yeah, okay. Towards the end of the 20s, beginning of the 30s, with some experimentation. Okay, everybody went, yeah, great, we can hear what people are saying on the screen. Whoops, but he's speaking Danish, and he's speaking Swedish. I understand nothing. So what do we do? Obviously, filmmakers didn't want to lose foreign markets. They had to think of a solution. And this was a bit bumpy. Lots of experimentation in the early 30s. If you can find any of these old films, they're quite interesting to look at. The first solution that American majors thought of were multiple versions, which sounds great in theory, but it was a bit crap, really. So, for example, The Big Trail, a Western film starring John Wayne, you know, typical Western film. Great, excellent. Same set, same costumes. As soon as the American crew had finished shooting the film, they give the same costumes and the same set to an Italian crew, and they shoot the same film, exactly the same, same movements, same scenes, same everything, in Italian, with a different actor. And the same in French, in German, in all the major languages. Excellent. They ship the film to Italy, and everybody goes, great, but where's John Wayne? We don't want that guy. We've never seen him before. So, not a great idea. But it was, you know, they produced quite a lot of these multiple versions, both in America and also in Paris, near Paris, the filmmaking studio is called Joinville, and in Italy as well. It was seen as a viable solution for a while, but then it was abandoned. Then they thought, okay, we'll add a narrator. If people can't understand the language, we'll superimpose a voice that describes what's going on, just the key elements of the plot. Bit boring. No, it doesn't work. All right, we'll use intertitles like we did with the silent movies. So we'll insert some black scenes, black shots, with the translation of the key elements of the dialogue. Great, except that sound films were not meant for intertitles. There was a lot of dialogue. So the adverts that you saw in the film papers at the time said, films spoken, 100% spoken, 100% sound, and people started going, yes, 100% read, because there was so much reading that you had to do that the film became really boring, and you ended up reading and reading and reading and not watching the film at all. So it didn't work. In Italy, they did something that was even worse. They silenced those films. So they took the soundtrack away again, and they used intertitles. They pretended that there were sound films, that there were silent films. It didn't work either. So, finally, somebody had a miraculous idea, genius idea. It's difficult to say who, because all these experiments took place in different countries, more or less at the same time, but in France, in Hungary, in various places, they started thinking, well, perhaps instead of adding an intertitle, we could try and superimpose the title on the image, on the bottom part of the screen. And so they created the subtitles. First by an optical method, by taking pictures of all the captions and then photographing them onto each scene, which took quite long, but it was effective. Then with a chemical method. And then finally, in later days, nowadays we use laser, which is much more precise, and it is able to cut all the letters and all the characters quite in a very defined way on the image. And of course, with digital films, you know the problem doesn't exist anymore, because you create the subtitles with the computer and then you mix them into the image, no problem. Someone else in Germany thought, well, we already use a dubbing studio for post-synchronization to re-record some of the scenes in the same language where the sound wasn't good. We could try and use the same technique to replace the original dialogues with dialogues translated into another language. And so they invented dubbing. Now, some countries, Italy, Germany and Austria, Spain, France to an extent, but not exclusively, decided to go for dubbing straight away for various reasons. The most important reason was certainly political, because they were under a dictatorship. And dubbing provided a great opportunity to manipulate undesirable dialogues in certain films. So if there was, for example, during the war, references to England were forbidden in Italy because they were our enemy. So there's a famous Alfred Hitchcock film called The 39 Steps, where a man is on the run from the police because they think he's murdered somebody. He goes to the station and catches the train called the Flying Scotsman, goes to Scotland in hiding, and he gets there, and it's very Scottish. You see people with kilts everywhere. You see Highland cows. It's very visibly Scotland. But in Italy, for some reason, he emigrated to Canada. And people were like, okay, Canada, why are they wearing kilts again? Not sure. Doesn't work. So it was a bit ridiculous, but there you go. But that was not the only reason. There were also linguistic and cultural reasons. Cinema going was a mass pastime at the time. And by mass, we mean mass. Everybody went to the cinema all the time. There was no television, a bit of radio, but not that much. And so people went to the cinema a lot. And a lot of people were still illiterate. So if you chose subtitling, those people would need the help of somebody to read the titles aloud for them because they couldn't read. And economic reasons as well. Dubbing was very, and is, very expensive, and you could only use it in countries where you had enough potential viewers to offset the cost. So it was not even conceivable for countries with so-called minority languages, countries with, you know, a small population. But at the same time, in those countries, Italy, Germany, Austria, Spain, etc., it was also a great industrial opportunity for the film industry, because there were protectionist measures which imposed dubbing to be carried out in the country. So only in Italy could you dub in Italian, only in Spain could you dub in Spanish. And so you were able to boost the national cinema industry as well by creating this other activity related to it. In other countries, like you know, countries with a lower population and with less commonly spoken languages, they had to go for subtitling. They had no choice, really. And there was an unexpected consequence, because with the invention of sound films, deaf people found themselves excluded from this new form of entertainment. But at the same time, blind people, for the first time, were able to access films a bit through at least the dialogues. Then in the 1950s, with the invention of television and the growth in international distribution of films, TV series, documentaries, etc., the demand for translation services increased, and it increased even more in the late 1990s with the advent of the DVD, which made it possible to have multiple audio tracks and multiple subtitle versions. Then satellite and digital terrestrial television with a boom in contents, and internet-based platforms, and especially over the last year and a half, I don't need to tell you why. We're all stuck at home watching TV obsessively. And so multiple language versions, SDH, audio description services, they've been booming over the past year and a half, which is good, but it's also dangerous, because content is being produced very quickly, and these versions need to produce very quickly as well. So there's not a lot of time for quality control. So just to sum it up, roughly, Austria, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, dubbing. Then in Eastern European countries belonging to the former Soviet bloc, they went for voiceover dubbing, which was not synchronous. But nowadays, most of them have opted for subtitling. The traditional subtitling countries are, you know, the smaller countries or the countries with the smaller population. And of course, UK and Ireland, a special case, as usual, because First of all, because the import market for AVT for AV productions is lower. The majority of products that they import are from English-speaking countries anyway, so they don't need to translate anything. And they also have a strong export market. However, recently, especially in the UK, there's been a lot of popularity for foreign TV dramas with subtitles, especially Scandinavian crime thrillers, Italian crime thrillers, etc. And it might be, I just thought I'd mention, I don't know if you know it, there's a channel also based on the web called Walter Presents, which is specialized in a specialized streaming service in foreign drama from all countries. And it's quite interesting because you can watch a Brazilian drama followed by a French crime thriller and then something else with subtitles, which for people living in mainland Europe is not such a novelty, but for people living in the UK it is, because there was hardly any programs from other countries up until maybe 5 or 10 years ago. Okay? Right. So, how is it done? Let's start from dubbing. It's quite complex and quite long. First of all, the foreign language film is bought by, the distribution company sells the rights to a country. Say that this is taking place in Italy, for example, but it's the same in France or Germany or other countries. First of all, you choose a dubbing director. A dubbing director is the same as a film director, except that they are specialized in casting voices. So they try to cast the best voices that match the original voices as closely as possible. You choose the actors, the voice talents, and of course the pool of available dubbers is never as wide as the pool of actors. And that's why you have dubbing actors who become famous as the voice of Russell Crowe and, I don't know, Robin Williams, and you go, oh, but their voices are completely different. Okay, I know, but we have a lot of films to translate, lots of actors, and not enough dubbing talents. Then they extract the dialogue track, which is the only part that needs to be translated. They produce a dialogue list. A dialogue list is a list of all the dialogue that is mentioned, and sometimes, if it's produced properly, it also includes details such as road signs or shop signs, telegrams, and other verbal aspects that you need to translate. But you, as a translator, when you receive a dialogue list, you have to check it against the film, because sometimes they're very poorly produced. Sometimes they are given to a trainee in the distribution company, they're given the film and they say, you, transcribe that. And sometimes they mishear some words and they write, garbled TV, garbled lines. You choose a translator and an adapter. They're not the same thing, but some people are able to do both. The translator produces a rough draft of the lines, of the dialogue lines. Then you do dialogue adaptation, which means that you go over the translation and try and match it to the images. And in particular, it's important for the dub lines to match the lip movements of the actors in close-up scenes. It doesn't matter so much in long shots, because you can't see the faces clearly. Or if the actor has their back turned to the camera, that's great, because you can make them say whatever you want. But when they are in close-up and you see the lip movements clearly, you see the facial expressions, you have to make sure that the words in Italian or French or whatever reflect the similar lip movements, which means that sometimes you have to change the translation slightly, because you might have some words that do not match at all. For example, if in English, if you have the word yesterday, in Italian that's ieri, which is a bit shorter, but the lip movement is very similar. Yesterday, ieri, great. Today, oggi, not the same thing. Today, oggi, nope. So you have to turn it around and perhaps start the Italian sentence with a word beginning with a T, related to the rest of the line, and then perhaps add oggi at the end or somewhere else. Because otherwise, viewers can realize that the film was in a different language. Of course, they know that originally it was in a different language, but you are all aware, you all know the phenomenon called suspension of disbelief. When you watch a film, you have to try and immerse yourself in the film, you have to try and believe it. So you can't be distracted by, you know, lip movements that don't match the words that you hear. So that's really important. Then the recording shifts are organized in the dubbing studio. This is very complicated because it's based on the availability of the actors who tend to work on different films at the same time. And so sometimes when there's a dialogue between two people, they're not necessarily together in the dubbing studio at the same time. Sometimes they go in, they record their lines, the other one goes in on a different day, and then it's mixed by the mixer. So not ideal, but sometimes it has to be done. Of course, the dubbing director is there present to give indications to the actors, like a film director. So, for example, if he's not happy with the intonation or the speed or, I don't know, the quality of the voice, they can say, you'll try and make your voice a little bit lower here, try to whisper there, or make this syllable a bit longer, etc., etc. And there's a sound specialist who works at the mixing desk, because nowadays, of course, there's specialized software which makes it possible, if a line has been recorded quite well, it's not quite perfect, but it's good, so you wouldn't want to do it again, then the person working at the mixing is able to prolong a little bit the duration of one syllable by maybe, I don't know, 1/3 of a second to make it match perfectly, and you don't hear it, there's no distortion nowadays. So when you have the foreign language dialogues recorded, so not in chronological order, you record them, you know, depending on when the actors are available, you mix them all together with the international soundtrack, which includes the noises, the music, the songs, etc. And then you have the dub film. It's complex, it's long, takes a while, and it's very expensive because you have to pay for the dubbing director, for the voice talent, for the rental of the dubbing studio with all the equipment, the sound specialist, etc., etc. So, as you can see, it's only worth doing if you know that that film is going to be watched by lots of people. Otherwise, it's not worth it. Any questions at all? Is it clear? Yeah, okay. So, these are all people that are typically involved in a dubbing session. Now, the main constraints, of course, are as follows. The main goal, as I said, is domestication, which means that when you watch a dub film, you, as a viewer, should feel that the experience is very similar to watching a film in your own language. You shouldn't be able to feel the difference. Of course, you know that the film is taking place in a foreign country. If you watch Hugh Jackman in Australia, you know that he's Australian, and they're in Australia, and everything's Australian. But he's speaking Italian, and it's quite natural to you. How do you do it? You have to pay attention to articulatory synchronicity, which means both quantitative or isochrony, which means that the target language lines must have the same duration as the original lines. They can't be longer or shorter. There must be a similar number of syllables. There must be a similar rhythm, a similar syllable pattern as much as possible. And also qualitative compatibility between the target language sounds and the actor's lip and mouth movements. Vowels, labial and labiodental consonants are especially hard. Labials are b, p, the m, f, v, because you move your lips a lot when you pronounce when you make those sounds. So all of this means that, unfortunately, you are forced to manipulate the original language, the original dialogue, quite a lot. Ideally, you try to transmit more or less the same message, but very often you have to change the words to, you know, make sure you respect these constraints, otherwise it doesn't work. And you also have to bear in mind kinesic sync. When I mentioned that you translate the verbal signs, but you must also take into account the visual, that's exactly what I meant. You have to take into account the body movements, the gestures, the facial expressions that are not always shared across languages. So, you know, that all of head shaking in some cultures means no, in other countries it means yes, for example. And you all know that we Italians, you know, gesture all the time. And so, you know, we have lots of different gestures that are not clearly comprehensible to other cultures. And it's very funny when an American is trying to take the mickey out of you and they go, "Mamma mia," like that. And you go, "No, you understand nothing. I'm sorry. This means what the fuck do you want?" So it doesn't go with "Mamma mia," which is, "Oh, I'm tired," or "Not again." So they're not related. What are you talking about? So random, completely random. Or that means you're nuts, right? So we have lots of different ones, and in every culture, there are some that are shared and others that are not. If they are important to the plot, if they're relevant to characterization, for example, and you think that the gesture may not be clear to the viewers, you have to try and sneak in a translation of the gesture into the original line. Even though it wasn't in the original line, you have to add something to make sure that people understand whether the character is frustrated or happy or irritated by something, etc. So not always easy. Let me give you an example. I don't know if you know this gentleman, Jack Lemmon. It's a very old film, but if you haven't seen it, take it as a suggestion. It's a comedy. It's about this guy who's recently separated from his wife, who kicked him out because he's a nightmare to live with. He has all sorts of phobias and strange habits, and his wife just cannot tolerate him any longer. So he goes to live with a friend of his who's the complete opposite. He is like really relaxed, plays cards all the time, smokes, invites his journalist friends over every night, drinks whiskey, etc. So he's a manic obsessive, and the other one is like really laid back. And this is an example of the difficulties of dubbing. Let's see if this works.
What's the matter now? I got this. My ears are filling up. I got this sinus condition. It's the change in temperature I always get from air conditioning.
Maybe it'll go away.
No, it's all part of my allergies. I get them in the summer.
Only in the summer?
In the winter, too. I get them all year long. Allergic to foods. And pillows and curtains and perfumes. Can you imagine that? Allergic to perfumes? I used to drive Frances crazy. For a while, she couldn't wear anything except my aftershave lotion. I was impossible to live with.
Stop that, will you? What are you doing?
I'm trying to clear up my ears. You create a pressure inside your head, it opens up the eustachian tube.
Okay, let's see this in Italian. I know you don't understand Italian, but have a look at the technical aspects to see whether you think it's being well done or not. Now, there's a little bit at the beginning that was not included in the
clip. Felix, la smettiamo di parlare di Francis. Ma che cosa vorresti che facessi? Che la dimenticassi? Come posso dimenticare 12 anni di matrimonio così?
Lo so, ma questi sono i fatti e devi affrontarli. Non puoi passare la vita a piangere. Ti annoia perfino al cinema.
Cosa ti fa? Ho freddo, nell'aria condizionata. Ma perché la tengo sempre al massimo? Mi prenderò un'influenza.
La manda se hanno la coperta.
Sono pericolosi i condizionatori, sai? Io a Francis si cambia da letto, non glielo facevo usare d'estate.
Oh, chissà lei come ne era ferito.
Andiamo.
Dove?
Vieni, mettiamoci un altro tavolo.
Ah, scusa, non lo sapevo. Da presa adesso?
No, niente, ho un po' le orecchie che mi si bloccano, ho la sinusite e il cambio di temperatura me lo fa sempre l'aria condizionata.
Vedrai che è una cosa da niente.
No, io vedrei di tante allergie. D'estate mi vengono sempre.
D'estate soltanto?
Non è neanche d'inverno, mi durano tutto l'anno. Sono allergico ai cibi, ai cuscini, alle tende e ai profumi. Te lo immagini, uno allergico ai profumi faceva diventare furiosa Francis. Certe volte poteva mettersi solo la mia lozione dopo barba. Era impossibile vivere con me.
Non puoi smetterla.
Cerco di stapparmi le orecchie. E beh, si crea una pressione dentro la testa che stappa le trombe di Eustachio.
Example of traditional Italian dubbing. You know, in the 50s and 60s, Italy was well known for the quality of the dubbing. It was considered like a high quality prestige industry. Nowadays it is still being practiced at high levels, but unfortunately there's also much lower quality available because, once again, there's so much content that needs to be translated and not everything is of the same, you know, quality as a Neil Simon film, which at the time was one of, you know, he was one of the most popular film directors in America at the time. So nowadays, for example, if you dub a Woody Allen film, that's done very carefully because he's a very popular director in Italy. But perhaps a B movie from, you know, of a lower quality will be done much more quickly by a dubbing studio with a lower reputation. So you see, it's a bit more mixed. The quality is a bit more mixed nowadays. Okay, do you have any questions on dubbing before we turn on to subtitling?
I have a question, but it's about the film. Was it like speeded up or something like that? Or was it just like the Italian?
No, it wasn't speeded up.
How was it? Okay.
No.
Because like the gestures, yeah, okay, yeah, that's it. But it seemed like they, at least for me, they speeded up, so we couldn't really understand like the mouth gestures, and that's what I thought.
Okay. No, it wasn't even possible at the time. In 1968, they couldn't speed it up like that. I mean, nowadays you can, obviously. You can also manipulate duration of shots and duration of individual syllables, and the viewers can't really tell that, you know, that a manipulation has taken place. So nowadays it's become a bit easier. The software makes it much easier nowadays. At the time, dubbing was not done via software. It was done by physically cutting the film into scenes. Each scene would be linked, like to create a ring, and it would be put on the equipment so that the dubbing actor could watch the same scene in loop for like 10 times so that they knew the pattern, they got used to it, and then they would try to record it because it was all done physically on film. But nowadays, of course, they can. They can speed it up or slow it down if they want to gain, you know, a millisecond here and there, and it's useful. It's easier.
Thank you. I also have one question, but it was about the accessibility.
Yeah.
When they make the visual to verbal version for blind people, is it like usually only the dialogue, or do they like include, if there's, for example, like a long scene and there no one's speaking anything, so do they like?
No, it's only for silent scenes, because the dialogue there is no problem. I mean, blind people can listen to the dialogue.
Oh, so it's
what you need to describe, and Francesca, I'm sure, will describe this in detail next week. But you need to describe the action taking place on the screen and who's speaking, especially at the beginning, so that blind viewers can associate the voice to the character. You need to tell them who they are. I don't know, like Tom is a 30-year-old man with blonde hair, and he's a computer engineer or something, so that when they first hear the voice of Tom and then they hear him again, they know that he is the one who's speaking. And it's important for the narrator's voice to be chosen. They choose a voice talent whose voice pitch is different from the voice pitch of the actors in the film. Otherwise, you know, blind people might get confused and not understand who's speaking. So sometimes the
the audio description script is spoken by a woman, sometimes by a man. It really depends on the film and on the genre. And if it's done for children, for example, it sounds much more like a mother reading a fairy tale, that kind of intonation, you know, once upon a time, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. If it's done for a crime thriller, it's not monotonous. It can't be, he looks at her with dead eyes, you know, it can't be like that. It's not overacted either, because the AD voice talent is not an actor. They are like a radio speaker.
Yeah.
And the idea is to describe anything that is relevant to the plot that would not be comprehensible without some help. So, for example, in a crime thriller, you can hear, for example, the music getting urgent, you know, sort of dun, 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 and you know that the murderer is arriving on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, because you can see him, and maybe the victim has their back turned to the murderer, and the murderer is like that. So you need to tell them, because they don't know what's happening otherwise.
Yeah, but what about, like, for example, if I'm Finnish, I'm watching a film that's in Italian, so I don't understand the language, then is there, like, one person reading that dialogue for me in, like, my language or English?
You have an AD narrator telling you what's going on in the images, and then you have another person reading the subtitles.
Interesting.
You have the audio subtitles, yeah.
So it's like two people.
Yeah, yeah, usually it's two people. Otherwise they get confused that they don't know what's dialogue and what's narration.
Wow.
Yeah. Cool. I'm sure Francesca will play you some examples. It's quite interesting. But now, I mean, if you're interested and you are... Right, so, just quickly, on subtitling, the process is much more straightforward. Again, you sell your foreign rights abroad, you extract the dialogue, you produce a dialogue list, the list is given to the translator. Then the first thing you need to do is spotting. Spotting means to insert the time codes for the subtitles, when you want your subtitle to appear and when you want it to disappear. And you also do the translation and adaptation. Now, spotting can be done separately from the translation, especially if you're in a hurry. So in a film festival, you have a spotter who deals only with the technicalities, and then they give a spotting list, which is like a file with just the time codes, and the subtitler fills in the translation. Or if you have more time, the person can do both spotting and translation at the same time, which is more natural in a sense. Then someone else does the subtitle revision just to make sure that there are no typos, no spelling mistakes or no translation mistakes, and then you have the subtitle film. So it's much easier. Of course, it's expensive if you are going to superimpose by laser the subtitle on the film. And for example, if your film is competing here in Venice, you have to have the Italian subtitles, but it's probably an expense worth making only for festivals, because, you know, that copy of the film with Italian subtitles will be no use to the film production company. And that's why you also have electronic subtitles that are displayed underneath on the screen, because those do not impact on the image at all. Yeah.
So what's the difference between the laser and the computer subtitles? Well, I didn't understand this.
Well, if you use laser, you can burn the subtitle into the physical film. I'm talking about analog film, not digital.
So, for example, on a DVD?
No, on a DVD, there's no need, because it's all digital.
Okay.
With digital, it's easy. But if you're physically making a film with the old film, the actual film, you need to burn the subtitles into the image, and you only do it if you know that you're going to use that copy more than once, because it's expensive.
Okay, and in Venice, they...
In Venice, in order to compete, they have to have Italian subtitles, because we're in Italy, so...
Yeah, but in Venice, so they do the laser ones?
The film production company does the laser ones. They send the films already subtitled for the competition.
Yeah.
But then Sub-T produces the electronic subtitles,
which
are displayed underneath.
Okay.
Because, you know, if you have a German film in competition with the Italian subtitles on the image, you need the English version underneath for international guests. So they always have to have at least two versions.
Does that mean that the films in Venice are not digital?
I think most of them are not, actually, but I don't know. You would have to check the production notes, but I think a lot of them are still traditional.
Okay, interesting. Mm. I didn't know that.
We'll have to research the catalogue and find out. But I get the impression that most of the ones in the main competition are not digital.
Okay.
So anyway, that's the workflow. The idea is foreignization, meaning that watching a subtitle film, you get access to a different language and culture. So you want to be exposed to a foreign language and culture. You don't want the foreignness of the film to be erased like in dubbing. You have a written rendition of the dialogues, on-screen text, lyrics, etc. Now, the main constraints, of course, are time, space, and diamesic shift. Time, because the subtitles must be synchronized with the dialogue. Ideally, they appear when the person starts to speak, and they disappear when they finish speaking. You have a limited amount of space, and a limited number of characters available per line, and you have to distribute the text in a sensible way to make reading easy. And you transform spoken lines into written dialogue. But watching a film with subtitles is, from a cognitive point of view, different from watching a film in your own language because you're performing an additional operation. Without the film, you can roam about the image and look at what you want. With subtitles, you are listening to the original soundtrack, but your eye, your gaze is attracted to the subtitle. Even if it's in a language that you don't know, your gaze automatically goes there to check. So subtitles and images compete for the viewer's attention, which is important, which means that you have to pace them properly, because the pace of a subtitle film is not determined only by editing, but also by the appearance of the subtitles, which is something that a filmmaker needs to bear in mind. If you don't want your viewers to miss important details in the images, you have to make sure that the subtitles don't stay on the image too long, for example. So, we haven't got... do we have enough time? How long do we have? Yeah? Okay. I'll just show you this. So, we move our eyes voluntarily to explore the images, and sometimes we may miss what we're not looking at. So have a look at this and follow the instructions.
This is a test of selective attention. Count how many times the players wearing white passed the basketball. How many passes did you count? The correct answer is 15 passes.
Did you get it?
But did you see the gorilla?
Did you see him?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah, we watched that in college.
Okay, so you knew that.
So I remember, yeah.
But it's interesting, right? Because when you're really focused on something, you tend to disregard other things.
This video was searched by Daniel Simon, Christopher Shabri, and his
copy. Yeah, I remember the first time you won the class, nobody. So.
Yeah, because you're so immersed in counting. And so this is, they look a bit weird, but this is something obtained with an eye tracker, which is like a special type of glasses that you wear, that record your eye movements to see where your gaze is going. So our eyes are immediately drawn to the written text. It doesn't matter if it's in our language or not. So after reading, then we explore the images. So here you can see that there were no subtitles in this image. So different people looked at different things, and they explored the image however they wanted. Here, there's a subtitle, and almost everybody went here first and then started exploring the image. So it's something that you need to bear in mind, because if at the beginning of a shot there is a very important detail in the upper part of the image, you might want to delay the insertion of the subtitle, otherwise people might miss it. And also reading speed. There's a problem. People tend to speak faster than viewers can read. So if you transcribe everything, if you translate absolutely everything that is being said, people can't keep up. They can't read everything. And also, two lines of subtitle are not enough. You would have, like, five lines. And it would mean that you basically read a film instead of watching it. And the faster the dialogue, the more time you spend reading the subtitles. So, have a look. Average reading speed of adult viewers is estimated at 66% of average speaking speed, which means that you have to reduce, you have to condense. Otherwise, people will not be able to read the subtitles in full. Of course, it's difficult to estimate the right speed because it depends on people's reading ability and it also depends on the medium. On TV, generally, it's about 140, 150 words per minute. On DVDs, higher, and in the cinema, it's higher. Because in the cinema, when you watch a film, you tend to be more focused. When you're watching a film on television, you're at home and you might get distracted or go to the kitchen and get a glass of water or something. And DVD, of course, is higher because you can pause it and rewind it if you miss something, which is not something that you can do with the cinema generally. And it's on the rise. One of the benefits of streaming platforms that we've been so exposed to is the fact that people's reading speed has increased over the last few years. So what happens if the subtitling is done by somebody who is inexperienced, somebody who doesn't know what they're doing? Or if dialogue is very fast. Again, a Woody Allen film is a typical example. They talk and talk and talk and talk and talk all the time. Or without taking into account film editing and shot types. Why do I say this? Because a subtitle cannot remain on the screen if there's a shot change in the background. If the shot changes, you automatically start rereading the subtitle because your eyes think that it's a new subtitle. So it's not voluntary, but it's called straddling. Your subtitle cannot straddle across two different shots. So if you have very fast editing, like in action films, you have to make sure that your subtitle in the first scene disappears before you change the shot. Otherwise, people start reading and rereading the same thing over and over again. So what happens if you don't take any of this into account? You spend all of your time reading instead of watching, like in this example here.
Okay, he's invited for dinner in the bottle city of Candor. He miniaturizes himself, enters the city where he loses his superpowers. Now, before dinner, his host says, "Who's up for a little Kryptonian tetherball?"
So did you see, the only time the viewer was able to look at the character was at the very end of the clip. All the dots, all the various viewers, various colours, they showed you that they basically only read the subtitles. They didn't look at the picture at all. Now, I know this is not like a Bergman film, but still, you will want to look at it a bit. Yeah. So if it's done properly, you work in collaboration with the creative team to make sure that the subtitles are fully visible. They're clearly legible. If you work in collaboration with the director, you can actually choose the font. If they have a preference for the font, they have preferences for film credits. Why should they not choose the font for the subtitles as well? It can be part of the film. You make sure that they are fully visible, and for example, when there are opening credits in the bottom part of the image at the beginning of a film, you make sure that the subtitles are moved up. Otherwise, they cover the film credits. And above all, you have to take into account the fact that subtitles are not an autonomous text. You read a translated book on your own as if it were written by Émile Zola in Italian. You do not read subtitles for pastimes unless they are with the film. You always watch them with the film, which means that you can exploit the principle of polysemiotic redundancy. If there is something that is clearly comprehensible thanks to the images, you don't need to repeat it in the words, in the subtitles. Otherwise, it would be like superfluous reinforcement. So if people say, "Hi," it's quite, even if you don't speak English, it's quite obvious what "hi" means. So you don't need to write "ciao," right? Or if people keep repeating the other character's name, like in American films, they keep saying "Tom, Tom, Tom" all the time. You write it two or three times so that people get used to the character's name, but then you can get rid of it. spotting I've told you about. And just for your interest, if you have a two-liner, a title with two lines, the ideal screen time, display time, is called the six-second rule. So it can stay on the image between 4 and 6 seconds, not longer, because studies done by psychologists have shown that if you display it longer, then the viewer will start rereading it again automatically, and you don't want that, it's pointless. But if it's one line only, between 1 and 3 seconds, it can't be less than 1 second, because otherwise you have what is known as the flashing effect, which means that the eye doesn't really register the words, you haven't got time to read them properly. In the absence of other constraints, a two-liner is better than 2 one-liners. Because if you have more words in a subtitle, you spend less time on individual words. It means that you're left free with a bit more time to explore the image and to actually look at the picture. So it's important. Filmmakers generally don't know these things because they're not exposed to them. It's a good idea to tell them simply because when they are editing a scene, if it doesn't cost them too much to add half a second to a shot, that enables you to have a one-liner. I mean, sometimes they will say, no, no, it has to be done like this. Okay, well, I'll think of something. But most of the time, the editing is done, intuitively. And they don't realize that a difference of maybe literally half a second can make a big difference to the translation, because it enables you to have, if you have like 4.5 seconds instead of 3 seconds, it means you can put a lot more dialogue in the subtitle and be more faithful. Legibility, of course, you know that they're usually in the bottom part of the screen. The number of characters tends to be 40, 42 per line maximum, although it changes a bit depending on the medium, DVD, cinema, television, teletext. The characters tend to be simple, streamlined, no frills, such as Courier, Arial, Times New Roman. But if you have a director who wants Broadway, okay, give him Broadway if he likes it. He chooses everything else in the film, why shouldn't he choose the font? And you could use colour if you wanted to. Some filmmakers in Japan especially, you know, a bit more experimental, anime film directors have been experimented with different colours, with different positions on the screen, or even placing the subtitles inside balloons, which is a bit extreme, but again, it could be part of their creative idea, why not? And finally, readability is very important. You have to have logical line breaks. You must not separate a preposition from a noun, you know, with your help. No, with your help has to stay on the same line. You must not separate, say, an auxiliary from a past participle. And if you have short sentences spoken by different characters, you combine them into a single subtitle, question and answer subtitle. And of course, when you have overlapping voices, like when people are quarreling, you have to leave something out. You can't reflect everything, so you decide which character's lines you will translate. Again, because there is a degree of subjectivity, if you were able to get involved with the director, you could ask him or her, you know, what do you think is the key element here in the dialogue? What do you want me to preserve? I haven't got time for everything. Okay, text reduction. You know, people who do not know a lot about subtitling tend to think that there's not a lot there, you know, that you leave out lots of things. And it's true, you have to, and I've explained why, but it's important to do it logically. So, you leave out anything that is clearly comprehensible by the images, you leave out repetitions or redundant elements. You tend to leave out items without a semantic value, such as conversation markers, well, you know, etc. Of course, if you have space and time, you preserve them because they are typical of conversations, but if you're pressed for time and space, they can go. They're not that important. You can leave out some synonyms. If you have a list of adjectives, you can leave out maybe one adjective. But you have to analyze each character, because sometimes a character has a catchphrase or a special idiolect, a special way of speaking, and so you have to try and preserve it in the foreign language. Punctuation, well, you know, these things are a bit too technical for you. Let me just go to the very end. Just to finish this off really quickly, with the opening scenes of a film, I don't know if you've seen it, it's called Filth, by John S. Byrd, a Scottish film director. And it's based on a novel by Irvine Welsh, the writer who wrote Trainspotting. I would like you to have a look at the opening lines and then just at the very end, based on what I've told you so far, what you think are the hardest parts in this opening scene for a translator, what you would need to take into account, what is difficult from a technical point of view. Okay, there's no test, I'm not going to mark you, so... And if you haven't seen it, it's a very good film.
Scotland. This nation brought the world television, the steam engine, golf, whiskey, penicillin, and of course, the deep-fried Mars bar. It is great being Scottish. We're such a uniquely successful race. As my wife Carol always says, there's no place like home. Always being played.
Okay, what do you think?
The timing, because he has like a rhythm, he's speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I have a question related to that. So it was in that part, it was saying like goal or something.
Yeah.
And so like slowly, in that part, he just did one word at a time. For example, he said something with a slow timing.
You can't do it like that. If you do it like that, people will keep. That people's attention will be constantly at the bottom of the screen.
Yeah.
So you have to put three or four of those items into a two-liner, and then another three or four in a second two-liner.
Even if you say it's slower.
Yeah. The, of course, pace is very important here. The music also reflects his pace of walking. It's done, you know, on purpose. And another important aspect, I think, is irony. Because he mentions all the inventions made by great Scottish people, and then he says, we are a uniquely successful race, and then it pans to three people who don't look especially successful or especially intelligent. So it has to be done in a very concise way, but it's important to translate that. We're especially a successful race, and then that's our success. Then, what else? What else do you think might be?
The text is like rhythmic and it's like on the beginning of the shot, so probably people will just be looking at the text and not the, you know, what is there new on the screen, I guess.
Yeah, so that the timing is important. You have to ensure that the subtitle appears immediately, the minute he opens, or he, it doesn't open his mind because it's a voiceover, but precisely because it's a voiceover, we can perhaps, you know, gain a little bit of time and perhaps make it appear half a second before the voice begins. So you save time and you enable people to explore the image and try and understand where they are. If you are familiar with British culture, you might have recognized Edinburgh Castle, and there's also a sign that says Royal Mile, which is the main street in Edinburgh linking Edinburgh Castle to the Royal Palace of Holyrood. And if people know Edinburgh, they will spot it and they will realise it. And then he goes down to the Grass Market, which is where J.K. Rowling went to write Harry Potter, in one of those cafes. So again, Victoria Street is a very popular street. So you have to make sure that viewers have time to explore the images. And there's also the presence of a gesture. Again, it's fairly international. I don't think we need to translate this. I think people understand it. But there might be other cases in which there's a more obscure gesture, and in those cases you would have to add a subtitle to explain what it means. Yeah.
Also, I don't know how important it is, but like they have the newspaper with Japanese student murdered, so maybe that should be translated.
It is very relevant because he goes into a police station. We'll find out that he's a policeman and he's going to be put on that case. So you need to translate the headline of the newspaper, which of course means that the subtitler, before even attempting the translation, has to watch the whole film first and make note of anything that is relevant and then try and think of solutions. You can't translate scene by scene. Doesn't make sense. Okay? Now, I know this was only a taster, but I hope I've been able to give you some hints, some ideas, and something to take away with you. If you would like maybe a simplified copy of the presentation, I'm quite happy to send it to Ilaria for distribution. And if you have any questions, I will add my email at the bottom, and I'll be quite happy to, you know, be in touch. And it's been a pleasure. I hope you enjoy the rest of your Venice Festival experience, and see you around.
Fred Film Radio, 24/7 on Fred.fm and smartphone apps.